So we're going to move on now and talk about these specific cancers and the research that's been done in PARP inhibitors and then how that's translated into clinical practice. And for all of these, we're going to focus on the, you know, sort of the genomics of the disease. All of these, we'll talk about some of the key trials. But in ovarian cancer, there have been four major trials, phase three trials. We've talked about that before, phase three comparing sort of standard of care versus an experimental approach. So in these cases, using a PARP inhibitor or not as maintenance therapy. So we're going to talk about those trials and how they led to the current practice patterns. But I'm going to put this question out here to you, Katie, which is that right now, every single patient with ovarian cancer, A, needs a genomic profile. And we actually asked the audience about it. But the question is, should every patient with ovarian cancer have the issue of receiving a PARP inhibitor as maintenance therapy in the upfront setting? Katie, any thoughts?
I would be interested to see what the audience thinks. I think it should be considered and it should be discussed with every patient.
Offered, right.
Shared decision making, but should every patient in the front line get a PARP inhibitor? No, I don't believe that.
Yeah, no, I wanted to be real careful to say discussed with the patient because I guess, you know, we'll get into this, you know, question of whether or not there are patients who you can identify who won't benefit. But yeah, I'm certainly not saying everybody should get a PARP inhibitor. I'm just saying, well, I think that maybe it ought to be discussed. But in any event, Katie, can you talk a little bit about sort of the genomic profile of ovarian cancer? To me, it seems like of these four cancers, maybe the one that's potentially the biology would suggest you might see the greatest benefit. But can you talk about what you see in these patients?
Sure. So, you know, when I was a fellow, which is getting longer and longer ago, the big phase three trials we did were just in ovary cancer. And we don't even talk about that anymore. It's very histology dependent. So we're talking about high-grade serous ovarian cancer here, which is the most common, and probably high-grade endometrioid. And that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about clear cell. We're not talking about low-grade serous. We're not talking about mucinous. We need to study those separately. So ovarian cancer has become a smaller disease. So I'm talking about high-grade serous here in this pie chart. And so what we know from high-grade serous so far is almost 50%, not quite 50%, of tumors will harbor some sort of vulnerability in their ability to repair DNA. The most common vulnerability is something related to BRCA. Either the patient has a germline BRCA mutation, and it geographically varies, but it's about 15 to 17% in the United States. About 7%, maybe 10% will have a normal germline test, but their tumor will have deleterious mutation identified in the tumor. So they're a somatic BRCA mutation carrier. And then there's maybe another 10% who have BRCA1 promoter methylation. So the gene looks totally normal, but there's no protein. And they act just like BRCA in terms of their response to PARP inhibitors. And then, as was discussed prior, there's a number of homologous recombination repair genes that are mutated in like 1% to 2% frequency. So we see PALB2, and we're not sure about that as a predictive biomarker only because we haven't learned enough about it. RAD51, we certainly have learned enough about, and that is a predictive biomarker, and others. So that's kind of the 40%, which is why you see these all-comer indications, because it's quite a large chunk of the population that has some vulnerability to PARP inhibitors by virtue of those changes.
So what we're talking about here, in the past in ovarian cancer, PARP inhibitors have been proven to be effective in the relapse setting. But what we're seeing now are trials in the upfront setting, patients after they've had debulking surgery and a chemotherapy. And Deb, before we talk about sort of the trials, maybe comment on sort of how the patients are at that point in time when you begin talking about the possibility of PARP maintenance, what kind of physical condition they're typically in, what are some of the issues you brought up with your patient that we talked about before in terms of what to expect with PARP inhibitors?
Well, generally, patients are pretty tired when they've just finished 6 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy. They're tired of not having an appetite. They're ready to get their lives back. They're tired of coming in for weekly labs and frequent visits. But they're also to a point where they have a lot of anxiety because they've been treating on chemo that we tell them it could be potentially so effective in their care. and then what's next? And they want to be proactive. And so they want to have the information to make the decisions about what to do next. You know, surveillance, maintenance therapy, clinical trial on maintenance. This patient, I met with her as she was transitioning off of her chemotherapy. I mean, she had a lot of anxiety, but she wanted to be proactive and she wanted to use what was FDA approved for her cancer. We talked about convenience. We talked about side effects. We talked about continuation of cytopenias. We talked about potential issues with her other GI problems that she's had in her past medical history, because she had significant GERD before she ever was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She worried about how taking a pill, and she had been on an oral study drug, so she knows how to take pills. Her adherence was not in question. She had a very strong knowledge base, but she wanted to be very proactive. But there is a lot of stress that these patients go through just because of all of the fatigue and the life altering, the body image altering. They've lost their hair. And for women, this is still a very important thing. They are always talking about getting back to some sort of normality. I just want to get my life back is what they talk about. They talk about this all the time.
I was just going to ask you, you know, on the other side of the question is the potential benefit. And, you know, in oncology all the time, particularly with new therapies, we're trying to convey to patient what the benefit is. Is it improving your cure rate? Is it delaying relapse? Right. What the magnitude is? And I'm curious what you tried to communicate to her, because the trials were, at least in the medical oncology community, people are very impressed by the benefit, at least in reducing the risk of relapse, almost 70% reduction in the BRCA germline case like her. How did you kind of communicate that to her?
I showed her the handouts and the data that we have from our prior studies and the information that's out there for ovarian cancer patients. I let her take that information home and let her mull that over with her family. She wanted to be proactive. She wanted to do what was best for her to get her to have the longest progression-free interval that she could have and tolerate the therapy, which she has. She made the choice also to ultimately to come off the trial and to go on to the olaparib. And we gave her the information to help her make that choice. But ultimately, that was her choice.
So Katie, maybe you could just kind of summarize what we know in terms of the impact of not only PARP inhibitors in this setting, the post-debulking, post-adjuvant chemotherapy setting, what the benefit is, and what are the considerations about whether to use a PARP inhibitor, what to use a PARP inhibitor. But another issue that's come out is whether or not to add in bevacizumab. So maybe we can just sort of, we're not going to go through every single data. Look at Katie's presentation, goes through every one of these trials. Deb's discussion goes through all these things. But more on a rounds-like level, Katie, can you kind of summarize sort of what the options are for patients and how you make that decision?
Absolutely. I want to come back to one thing that Deb said first, because it was really spot on. When these patients are finishing chemotherapy, they're very tired and they would much rather not do anything. And we know in certain molecular subgroups that PARP is tremendously beneficial. And so a key aspect in patients deciding whether or not to start a PARP inhibitor is really the investigator or the provider's attitude about the PARP. And so in her case, this is a patient not only with a BRCA mutation, but BRCA2. And if you look at the subset analysis of SOLO2, that actually has a ratio of 0.22. So, you know, it's almost an 80% reduction in the risk of progression. You know, those patients did very well. And so the counseling that was provided, while not being bullying, was pushing, was very much emphasizing that really observation is an option. If that's what you want to do, I'm going to support you. But it's not your best option. And these are the options that exist. The other key thing, and I love speaking at ONS because you guys are actually doing the work, is that when you start patients in the ovarian cancer sphere, at least on maintenance PARP, or your doctor says, start her on a PARP, and you go do that, you don't have to start it cycle 7, for example. So if someone gets 6 cycles and 21 days later, they're supposed to, you know, be cycle 7, you don't have to start the PARP 3 weeks later. You can wait 6 or 9 weeks and let patients recover and get over that fatigue and kind of get reset and feel a little bit better before you start that PARP, and that's going to incredibly help your compliance. So I wanted to say that. The question about bevacizumab is an excellent one, but it goes all the way back to your first question to me about deciding on surgery. Bevacizumab is really a decision we make. You know, there's kind of two decision points in ovary cancer. Well, I know there's many, but there's two main ones. The beginning, what are you going to do? You're going to do surgery up front or in the middle? Yes, no. Make that decision. Are you going to use Bev? Or are you not going to use Bev with your frontline chemotherapy? And you may not start it or have it around the surgery, but is it going to be with you in chemo? Because if it's going to be with you in chemo, it makes zero sense to stop it after six cycles. Like, that's not the benefit of bevacizumab at all. The benefit of bevacizumab is with and to follow. And so that was a problem with SOLO-1. The only problem with SOLO-1, I'm a little biased, was that in order to get olaparib, if you started bevacizumab because you had a patient with stage 4 disease or a lot of ascites that you could dry up faster, if you wanted to put them on olaparib with a BRCA mutation, you had to stop, which was uncomfortable for a lot of providers. And now you don't have to do that anymore with the results of PALA-1, which have made that approved not only for patients with BRCA-associated cancers, but also HRD positive. And so you can make that decision and then layer on the PARP. Yes.
Just to clarify that, when you talk about PALA-1, that was a trial that looked at the combining a PARP inhibitor, olaparib, plus bevacizumab, that seemed to be safe and effective. And now it's FDA approved, but it's the only PARP inhibitor approved with bevacizumab. Deb, I'm just kind of curious with your experience with bevacizumab and ascites. I hear a lot of people who see patients with ovarian cancer talk about the benefits of bevacizumab. Any comments on that? And also kind of tolerability, side effect issues with bevacizumab, Deb?
I'm going to start with the side effects, because one of the things that we're actually rewriting right now in my general infusion room is the management of patients and the following of how we manage the main side effect of bevacizumab, which is hypertension. When you have about 30% of all patients and some with absolutely no prior history of hypertension develop elevated blood pressures. So that is one that we're working with right now on how to manage it, when to bring in the primary care physician, managing it with patients on making treatment decisions, because we have quite a crew of advanced practice nurses and nurses that are at the bedside looking at blood pressure logs and calendars and a lot of these things that we use from prior studies to give us the tools and the protocols to be able to adequately treat these patients. So hypertension is a big one that can lead to the chronic kidney issues and the proteinuria, and we're always screening for nephrotic syndromes if they have these chronic hypertensions with delays. As far as managing side effects or the symptoms of cancer such as ascites, I mean, bevacizumab can be great at drying up ascites. It can be very effective against ascites, and it is very well tolerated too. Patients do really well. We talk about hypertension, but hypertension can be managed, but it has its own set of side effects. But as far as the ascites, anything else you wanted?
That was what I was going to focus on. Just to go back to Katie, though, in terms of, you know, choice of what you're going to do. So we talked a little bit about whether or not bevacizumab will be on the table, and if so, olaparib is approved with it. The other question is, if you have a patient who has a BRCA germline mutation, now we have two trials that have shown benefit, one with olaparib, one with niraparib with indication. But then you have the other patients who don't have BRCA germline. And maybe you can comment a little bit about what we know about PARP inhibitors with those, Katie.
Yeah, so there have been three studies now that I talked about in the video. PALA-1 that we referenced with bevacizumab, and then PRIMA, which used niraparib as switch maintenance. So in patients that had responded to their frontline chemotherapy with a partial or complete response, were then put on niraparib or placebo. And it was all comers, not just BRCA-associated cancers. And interestingly and importantly, was stratified by homologous recombination deficiency by the Myriad assay. Primary endpoint there was in all comers, but then specifically in that HRD positive group as well, co-primary endpoints. And that HRD positive group includes all of the patients, of course, with BRCA mutations. And then there's the VELIA study, which was veliparib with and to follow chemotherapy versus a control group that was chemo alone followed by placebo. And there's one other arm in there that hasn't quite been analyzed yet. And so for all three of those studies, plus SOLO-1, so there's four studies that have a very large cohort of patients with BRCA-associated cancer. So I wish we could combine it all, because it's the largest number of prospectively studied women with BRCA-associated ovarian cancer that we've ever seen. We can learn a lot from that database. But all of them were very consistent in terms of the amount of benefit from PARP inhibitor, kind of making it the standard of care. It's not an option. It's the standard of care. And if a patient chooses not to take it, that's okay. I mean, everybody has their individual decisions to make, but there's no, like, you could use this or single agent bevacizumab or this. Those aren't equivalent options. It's just PARP. That is the standard of care. I really believe that because of the magnitude of benefit is just unprecedented. In other groups, so BRCA wild type, meaning they do not have a BRCA mutation either in their tumor or blood, but they do have homologous recombination deficiency by some other way. SOLO-1 didn't include those, but the other three studies all did. And it's, again, very consistent benefit in that group as well. That's very clinically relevant as well. Hazard ratio is about 0.5. So again, you know, if you look at the PRIMA study, the median progression-free survival was doubled. So that group, again, I do think there's still some wiggle room. Patients can decide, and maybe is not the penultimate standard of care, but it's pretty high. And then you have the group of patients who, by the current assay that's being used, are classified as homologous recombination proficient, which means by this assay, you would say that their tumors are very good at fixing their DNA and therefore not super responsive to PARP. The only study to show that there was benefit to PARP in that particular group was PRIMA, which is the niraparib study, and that is why that particular PARP did get an all-comer approval for irregardless of biomarker for consideration of PARP for switch maintenance.
And of course, at this point with this follow-up, all we know is that there are a lot less recurrences. We'll have to see, is this going to affect survival? Is it going to end up curing patients? Another thing that's kind of interesting, Deb, about ovarian cancer, as Katie was mentioning, the drug niraparib is used, and really, it's the only drug I think you can use in this sort of theoretically non-proficient population. But one of the things that came out about niraparib was kind of interesting in terms of platelet counts dropping. Was it relating to patient weight and also baseline platelet counts? And now, routinely, I think it's under 177 pounds or 150,000 platelets. People have dose reduction. I'm just kind of curious, once you do that, Deb, what kind of issues you see with cytopenias, both with niraparib and olaparib in this setting?
I think patients respond really well once we get them to that dose reduction. Patients seem to recover and they maintain their counts pretty well. That's pretty much what I've seen, is they do really well once you dose reduce them. Some patients don't. Not all patients are going to respond well to dose reduction. Some patients are going to have prolonged cytopenias and they might have to have a second dose reduction. Sometimes it requires more than one dose reduction.